form our third final.
Good evening, Dr. Crawford.
What are you on Thursday?
Do you think it's worth watching the State of the Union this year?
What? Doesn't it say Matt Mike, like doing so crazy?
I never listen to State of the Union.
Isn't it a mitzvah? I listen to it every year. Because you're hearing the nut, the king, the Nazi speak. Isn't it a mitzvah to hear? Maybe it's like a mitzvah because it's so honored.
If you have that in mind, then it's a mitzvah.
Wait, Rabbi, is that why you put emptying here tonight?
What's the state union?
President gives a speech every year.
About what?
The Congress, the State of the Union. Hello.
What's the state about this year?
Didn't you go to like history class ever in school?
I messed up a lot.
It shows.
That's why I'm here. I'm a high school dropout, and you have a second option.
No, but is IFCA?
I think you'd be a good one.
President is required by the Constitution to give a message to the Congress every year on the State of the Union.
In our perusal of Jewish history, last time we spoke about the Maharal. And we came with the Maharal into the 1600s. Now, of course, we thought the Maharal was just one of many, many great scholars who lived at the time. But I want to skip ahead in events to the mid-1600s. Because the mid-1600s and late-1600s were critical times in Klal Yisrael's history. Perhaps more critical than any time until the Second World War. Even more than the Inquisition. The 1648 was predicted by some Kabbalists to be an auspicious year during which it was likely that Mashiach would come.
Why? The year of the Inquisition?
No, 1648.
What was
16th of day? Why was that predicted?
No, what was on 16th
of day? I didn't tell you yet. It was supposed to be a good year for the Jews. Okay? What actually happened in 1648 is that there arose a leader in Ukraine of the Cossacks, Bogdan Khmelnytsky was a fighter for Ukrainian independence from the Poles. Now you have to understand that all these lands, Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine, they all went back and forth from Russia to Poland. You know, who was ever in charge, well, for one time was in charge later on, and they kept on switching hands. But another thing to remember is that Poland and Lithuania are Roman Catholic, and Russia and Ukraine are Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox. So they don't like each other so much, these
Ukrainians have the independent
church. Its own church, right? Ukrainian Orthodox Church, right?
I don't know, but it's independent.
Yeah, whatever. Okay, so that's all, but they're all generally under the Orthodox, which is the Eastern Church.
Oh, no,
the
another one, yeah.
Yeah.
Another one, the Orthodox.
Yeah. So in any event, these are all currents of friction and animosity which existed in the general secular world at the time. And a couple of other things I want to give as a backdrop. First of all, the Jewish community in the Poland, Lithuania, parts of the Ukraine, were highly organized. They're organized into a council called the Council of the Four Lands, which are Poland, Lithuania, Volhynia, which is, I guess, a district in one of them, and Moldova, I believe.
Bohemia?
Maybe Bohemia is the other one. And this Council of the Four Lands, Zavad Arva Rotos, would meet at regular intervals, usually when twice a year, when there were major commercial fairs in the big towns, and they would deal with issues which arose in the communal life of the Jewish community throughout these lands. Now, the reason why Jews enjoyed such autonomy is not because Jews were so united and so wonderful, got together so wonderfully well, but rather because the non-Jewish government liked dealing with the Jews as a body. They didn't like having to deal with individual Jews, especially in the matters of taxation. They just wanted their taxes. They really didn't care how the Jews raised it. They wanted the taxes from the Jews. So therefore, they gave the Jews autonomy internally in order to make the relations between themselves and the Jews flow more smoothly. So this council existed from the early 1500s till the mid-1700s, when it was expanded by the Polish government. And as I said, it had significant autonomous power throughout the region. We'll come back to some of that later on. Another thing to remember, which is very fundamental to this discussion, is that Jews in Eastern Europe, generally speaking, had jobs which made them very unpopular with the surrounding population. Specifically, they were generally, speaking, the rent collectors for the barons and noblemen who held large estates. So they had to go from peasant to peasant and collect the rents which were due. And needless to say, the peasants didn't like the rent collector, or similar idea, the tax collector. Or they were kept inns and taverns, and inns and taverns, of course, provided alcoholic beverages, but at a price. And of course, they didn't want to have to pay the price. Nobody likes paying for these things. So these were occupations which, generally speaking, caused the Jews not to be liked by the surrounding population. They didn't really have much choice. They weren't allowed to own land, so therefore they couldn't become farmers. The other trades, blacksmiths and such like, blacksmiths or tanners and things like that, I guess that those were, they involved themselves in those trades, but there was a limited amount of money to be made there, so therefore they took up these positions as the representatives of the noblemen on their estates. So they were the agents to collect what was called in Yiddish, and I assume this comes from one of the Eastern European languages, the arenda. The arenda means... Right, okay, correct. There you have it, right? So yeah, you see in Tshuva literature a lot the word arenda, and it means the guy who's supposed to collect the rents from the peasants in the surrounding area and give it to the Polish nobleman, the graf, the count, who was in charge in that, who owned the land in that area. Generally speaking, until the mid-1800s, Eastern Europe was based on the serf system. The serf system means that, you know, as in feudal Europe, Western Europe, many hundreds of years earlier,
They went surfing,
right. That's not quite what it means. It means that all the land belonged to the noblemen, and the people who lived on the land lived at the nobleman's pleasure and on his terms. Okay? It's like semi-slavery.
This was meant by Yekaterina II.
Yeah, but it existed beforehand also. I think it existed also before. Because we're talking about in the 1600s now. So I think the land was owned by the noblemen, and they let people settle there for a price. That was the rent.
Yeah.
The,
one second. Originally, in Russia, they give everyone, so the noblemen, they give land, and then each one bought peasants, or was given, so some of them was given land, and sometimes mansions, and sometimes peasants. The rest of them have to buy peasants, and they give whatever they want, and they peasants pay to the nobleman rent, which is the third usually of the sort of the crops, whatever plus whatever was the rent is, which
right.
is the rent. Right. Yeah, sure.
By the way, the in the early 1900s, when I'm sorry, late 1800s, so that the I forget which czar he gave
Alexander II,
he eliminated. He's from Russia. Someone in Russia should know he eliminated the state for the feudal system, and then peasants themselves could own land. So the land owning peasants were called kulaks.
No. Original thing was like this. You want to give freedom, but the way it was a lot of discussion how to do it, but they want to free somehow peasants because it was better for economy. But they don't want to give full freedom, they have to have some matters, etc. But they don't want to have, in Russia, when you give freedom, it's always going to come to the way of the revolution, of kind of turmoil, etc. So it was like several commissions. Finally, one of them decided, we're going to do this. What he decided to do, he gave peasants freedom, but with certain conditions and without land.
Uh-huh.
While they have to pay for their freedom, I believe. Well, they have to pay something to the nobleman, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And that become everywhere. They read the order, which is, I assume, supposed to be freedom, and the peasants mm-hmm. take it like worst-case scenario. It's what they believe. They didn't believe for freedom without land. Because land was everything for them. They was crops, everything for them.
Okay. So that happened already earlier, and what I'm trying to say about in Poland is that the peasants rebelled against the noblemen. And that's essentially the Cossacks were a kind of semi-barbaric people who were very militaristic. And very aggressive and very ruthless, and they made excellent soldiers. To the Second World War, there were Cossacks in existence. The Cossacks fought in the Second World War on the side of the Germans,
because
yeah. they were right Russians. They were anti-communists. And after the war, the Allies repatriated everybody. They sent everybody back to the original land. So of course they sent the Cossacks back to Russia, where they were promptly all
murdered.
Right.
No, not all of them, many of them, most of them, but some of them
survived. Okay.
No, in the jail.
Anyway, so the Cossacks had detested the Jews for several reasons. First of all, they there was a lot of innate anti-Semitism in that area. Now you have to understand. During this time, Western Europe is undergoing the Enlightenment. And the intrinsic animosity which the church might have had for Judaism is weakening its grip. Because people are not so frum anymore. So when people are not so frum, the Christians I'm talking about, they don't detest the Jews as much. And Jews are slowly filtering into general society. In Eastern Europe, that was not at all the case. Eastern Europe was quite frum. Not only that, the Eastern religion, the Eastern Europeans are very superstitious. So therefore, they are very superstitious about the Jews and perceive the Jews, for the most part, as being bad people, children of the Satan. Besides that, they didn't have these unpopular professions. So therefore, when the Cossacks revolted in 1648, they, besides killing Poles, also killed Jews. They could have committed many, many different kinds of atrocities, and I don't want to get into it. We have young viewers here tonight. So it was many different atrocities of various different kinds, and they killed anywhere between 100,000 and 1 million Jews, depending on who you ask. And nobody knows exactly the number for sure. One of the most famous slaughters occurred in the city of Nemirov. Nemirov is in the Ukraine, I believe, or South Poland. And there, again, we don't know exactly how many Jews were killed, at least 20,000. And it says that the rivers of Nemirov ran blood. So they ran red. And before, when Rav Nachman, many years later, Rav Nachman Breslover needed a place to die, he knew he was dying, so he picked Nemirov. Because he said, this is a place where lots of Jews have died, is a place where it's a good place for me to die. And I believe he died in Nemirov, if I'm not mistaken. I believe his main comrade, Reb Nosson, was from Nemirov. But there are many cities like this, and there's a lot of cities which the Cossacks besieged. The Poles made deals with the Cossacks and basically sacrificed the Jews. Now, Jews fought alongside the Poles because they figured that we're part of this nation, which is now being attacked. We should defend it too. But the Poles, just so for the most case, whenever they were able to do so, sold them out in order to be able to make whatever agreement they made with the Cossacks. So this went on and off for several years, but the primary years of this rebellion are called Tach V'Tach. Tach in Hebrew is 408, Tach in Hebrew is 409, and Tach V'Tach corresponds to the years 1648 and 1649. This is almost 300 years, precisely 300 years since the Black Death, and all more or less 300 years before the Holocaust. These things are cyclical in Jewish history.
What's the Black Death?
Black Death is when
Shema.
So the
I think Jews did not die by the Black Death.
Right, that's why the Torah killed them.
What? But it doesn't really make. It's not the same rate
because they kept hygiene. They had better conditions.
Right, but it's not logical. But because the logical thing is, if someone's living and he's dying, the logical is to ask them, "What are you doing? And I'm not doing."
Okay.
So you see how anti-Semitism is.
They're afraid of him. He's causing.
I understand you. The logical thing is to assume that the Jews were poisoning the well.
Duh. You're sending rats to bite the people. Come on, man.
That's because of anti-Semitism.
No.
That was logical, though.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
So
they didn't have
much
of a
deal.
But they basically have this profession because they have
what? They know explanation,
they have this bad profession because they wasn't the
one. Oh, they didn't have a choice. Right, I said they didn't have a choice. That was why they were stuck in those professions. Wasn't it they chose them? What?
They took kosher food in here?
They had to serve kosher food because they had to eat themselves, so I assume it was part and parcel of their meals. But the hotels were more for drinking than for eating.
No, it wasn't hotels,
it was
called
Kachma.
Yeah,
it's different.
It's like a tavern. It's like Inn. It's like. But the hotel is what? I don't know. Like Inn. And Shinok, which is Kachma. Which is the restaurant,
bar. It makes sense because Jews like to eat and don't like to drink.
Kretschma is also used a lot in literature, so obviously that's the tavern. They're called, today you would call it a tavern, that's what you call it today. Anyway, so...
Do these attack like the Rome style as we know today? Or
sorry?
These attacks? Like it's
running around
as masculine Jews.
Now, this obviously caused a lot of theological difficulty because it was very hard, just like, you know, the Holocaust nowadays, many people have grave difficulty with explaining how God could allow such a tragic thing to happen. So through back then, at top of the top, many people had a grave difficulty understanding how Hashem could allow such persecutions and pogroms to have occurred. In back then, also, in an interesting harbinger of the Second World War, even though the Cossacks allowed conversions, when they didn't get enough conversions, they got upset at the converts and killed the converts too. So converting wasn't necessarily a guarantee of safety. Converting Christianity was not necessarily a guarantee for safety at the time, top to top. So the question was, how do you deal with these things? So there's a famous Misha Beirach from the Tesis Yontif. Now, Tesis Yontif was the author, was the Yontif, the Yontif, I think his last name was Teller. He has a commentary in the Mishnayos. His commentary in the Mishnayos is called the Yontif. And the Tesis Yontif was in that same Eastern European milieu with the Maharal and the Maharshal and other greats of the early 17th century, late 16th, early 17th century, and he wrote a famous Misha Berach. And the Misha Berach is very hard for me to relate to this Misha Berach. Has anybody ever seen the Misha Berach?
Very
close. And it's in a lot of Sidurim.
This fun, sir?
No. The Ashkenazim don't say it either. But it's there.
I don't know if it's not there or what.
Yeah, right.
You know
this?
He says it apparently.
How do you know?
Isn't it Kol Yaakov? What? Kol Yaakov, maybe that does it? Could be. Anyway, the Mishmeret of Yom Tov is that Hashem should preserve and safeguard and keep all those people who don't talk in shul. Now,
they have one up at the Bloomberg School. They have it up on the wall.
Yeah, my school too.
I like it.
They don't say it, but they have it up on the wall.
Talking.
I think in Rabbi Spiegel's school in New Hampstead, they say it every Shabbat in Barkin. And so there are different customs, but the point is, the Tzitzis Yontif is said to have said, and again, I have difficulty with this, that the reason why all these Jews were killed in Pach Levat is because people were talking during davening. Okay? Yeah, but that you know, in my perspective, that makes more sense. Because that means that they didn't have a relationship with God. But talking in shul, you know, doesn't seem, and other things happened as a result, right? Not that that was the only thing, but that was the catalyst. But here, it sounds as if Yontif, the way it's put, at least it was brought down to Zurich, that this was the be-all and end-all.
Okay, well, so if you want to ask something, let's say, to read Tachanun or not to read, or which page, blah, 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 is also considered talking or not?
What? No. So I think just, smoothing. Maybe talking about secular matters. It's not in here either. But the point is that the way I kind of rationalize that to myself, I don't know if I'm right, because I never saw exactly what Tzitzis Yontif wrote inside, but at least not that I recall, is that the Tzitzis Yontif is trying to find some thing which should be a kus for Klal Yisrael to get out of the Tachvatat situation. In other words, it's not that he meant the Tachvatat was caused because people were talking in shul, but rather, what was something which people could latch onto, some kus that they could get, which is relatively easy, which should be a kus for them to achieve some rest and respite from these wars. So that's the other made this Misha Berach. But generally speaking, again, as I said, the conventional understanding is that the first thing I said that because people are talking shul, that's why there's a tachvatat occurred. The Zera means decree. Any persecution is generally called a Zera in common usage. There is, and this probably is in this sitter, there is a tainus which the Vad Arbarotos made. Vad Arbarotos made a tainus for Chok Sivan, for the 20th day of Sivan, which I believe was the day in which Khmelnytsky and the Poles signed a peace treaty. So, which meant that they were both free to persecute the Jews.
Wasn't
the
Crusaders also happened on that in
Sivan? Yeah, but not Chav. They didn't make a fast on Chav. They didn't make a specific fast. The specific fast of Chav Sivan was made for Tachvatat.
When did the Crusaders, was a different day?
They pushed it off the Tisha B'Av. That's why we say the kinnis for the Crusades during the Tisha B'Av. But you should know also that the reason why Av HaRachman, the which we say Shabbos morning, the original custom was to say only on the Shabbos between Pesach and Purim and Shavuot, because that's when the crusades, the martyrdoms of the crusades occurred, and Av HaRachamim was made in commemoration of those martyrs.
And then what happened?
There are lots more martyrs in Jewish history, so they decided to say it every Shabbos.
It could only take twice a year.
What?
Before Shavuot, before Tisha B'Av.
Yeah, so it's interesting that the Germans made it, and they don't really even say it. Let's ask if there's one here. But in any event, Peter hasn't made getting back to our situation. So therefore, since Tachvatai was such a devastating event, and people were fishing around for some theological understanding of it, so people became much more mystical. Generally speaking, if you decide that the world is an illusory place, meaning that it's not real, and that the real world is the spiritual world, so then you can rationalize a lot more of what goes on in the physical world. In other words, you say, well, this is the imperfect world, which is just an illusion and a temporary stopping place for the soul. The real world is the mystical world, and that mystical world is one in which everything is good. So therefore, people became more mystical after this, and of course they were more depressed as well, because like everybody expected great things to happen, and instead they have these massive massacres which took place, and needless to say brought people's spirits very low. So the entire second part of the 17th century, Jews suffered from a collective mass and ongoing depression. Psychologists did very well during those days. Yeah.
Is it still from the beginning of the period of finding people who are not practicing religion any longer? They're becoming secular?
No, because
I heard someone use this as a benchmark for the first assimilation.
No, it's not accurate. Because in Eastern Europe, where the massacres occurred, there was no incentive, or even the milieu didn't exist not to become observant. Because the Christians were observant in their ways, the Jews were observant in their ways. There was no intelligentsia, right? Nobody was sitting around studying Aristotle. So where were they supposed to assimilate to?
So why the Musculum? That begins
Western then. Europe. Western Europe. Musculum is a Western European phenomenon.
So when does it start in Eastern Europe? When does it start?
Much later, 1800s.
So that's the first time people started to address.
No, they started assimilating Western Europe earlier than that.
But I'm saying in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, in Eastern Europe in the 1800s. Okay, not before.
So the Enlightenment movement, I've heard people say that was worse if that didn't happen, or if saying that it was such a strong movement. Can you comment on that? Like, there's a strong movement that, like, there's so many Jews that were going towards Enlightenment.
Well, I think you have to distinguish here between the Enlightenment and the Emancipation. The Enlightenment in and of itself was, generally speaking, weakened the grip of religion on society. But it was really emancipation which happened 150 years later or so, which actually opened the gates of the ghetto and let people go out and assimilate. So many great rabbis, perhaps the majority, were against emancipation. They preferred to be second-class, persecuted, inferior citizens. That's the Enlightenment, I don't think, was the issue per se.
When?
We're talking the Enlightenment like around 1700s.
Right, but start earlier than that.
Yeah.
Start in 1500s already.
Christians they also started reporting Jewish doctrines and churches.
No, I'm just saying, but all this is Western Europe. It's not taking place in Eastern Europe.
Right.
The Khmelnytsky masters are Eastern European. Okay? If you look at the map, they're very Eastern European. They occur, in the Ukraine, in Poland, Lithuania. This is not, at that time, the Jews in Germany, France, those places were relatively speaking, well off.
There were more Lutheran and Protestant areas of Europe.
I'm sorry?
And more Lutheran and Protestant areas of Europe. So in
they did better in Lutheran areas.
Right,
but
still, there
were
mostly
Catholic areas,
yeah?
Sorry?
Catholic areas?
Well, I don't think it made that much of a difference. As long as once you're outside of Spain, the Jews were okay. Okay, around that time, in the mid-1600s, I don't know if I mentioned this before, there was the revolution in England, and Cromwell took over from Charles after they beheaded Charles I, and then Cromwell was what?
Before it was revolution in France.
No, revolution in France was later.
Later.
Well, it was about the late 1700s. Cromwell took over as protector of England, so there was and this is in the 1660s, around the same time as the Khmelnytsky massacre, so there was a cavalist named Menashe ben Israel, who lived in Amsterdam, who persuaded Cromwell to let the Jews officially back into England. They had been booted from England in the 1290, around that time, and he let them back in. So,
did he know Jews that whole entire time?
Why he was
not officially. There were always Jews, you know, Jews like making a buck, so there were always Jews, you know, passing through trying to sell stuff. But,
why they were booted?
What?
Why they were booted?
Yes. Why they were booted? When things went bad, so the priests would tell the kings, you know, if you want God to be on your side, get rid of the Jews. That's what they did.
When the Shabbos
is Because it's coming up.
It was a very good time for him.
Absolutely. He took advantage.
Yeah.
He exploited this to his absolutely.
It seems from all the books I read that a lot of the guys, they were very scared of him.
We're jumping ahead.
Oh.
Okay. Let's go gradually until we get there. So the Jews of Eastern Europe were very depressed during this time, and the Jews of Western Europe, even though they were better off, were not that much better off, and certainly the Jews in Arab lands were not doing too well. So everybody's depressed. So along comes a fellow named Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was a subject of the Ottoman Empire, and he came around and proclaimed himself to be Mashiach. Now bear in mind, Rabbi, say anybody in this room, according to the Rambam, can step up to the plate and try and be Mashiach. Right?
Rambam,
Maimonides. It says there are only three things you have to do. You have to
Three small things.
You have to bring back all the exiles to the land of Israel.
Sure.
You have to destroy the enemies of the Jews. And you have to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash.
What do you mean exiles?
Oh, work of time.
Work of
what?
What do you mean exiles?
Halfway.
Exiles, people who are dispersed all over the world. Who to bring them back to Israel.
No,
what?
But Shabbat 3 didn't maintain
He claimed he was going to.
Give him time.
He was going around and, you know, trying to make people accept his leadership so that they would do all these things. Okay? And he was obviously a very powerful and persuasive speaker. And writer as well.
That time will probably die by now.
Yeah, but now the exiles are being let out. It means they have to be allowed to go back there to Israel.
They are allowed.
Nowadays, but not back then.
Yeah, nowadays they are allowed.
Yeah. That's why we're in Muncie. So in any event, getting back to Shabtai Tzvi, so Shabtai Tzvi was exploited brilliantly the state of the Jewish, general collective Jewish psyche of the time. Now, there have been lots of people who claim to be Mashiach throughout Jewish history. Many, many of them, right? But, and they've gone around trying to get people to believe in them, and they've gone around trying to convince kings and other world leaders that they were the Messiah, and they've done lots of stuff of that sort, but nobody ever went as far as Shabtai Tzvi. Most of them were regarded by the Jews themselves as kooks and crackpots, but not Shabtai Tzvi. We really can't understand it in retrospect. How pervasive, how extensive Shabtai Tzvi's influence was. Now Shabtai Tzvi didn't just come and say he's Mashiach. He invented a whole Kabbalistic system, which is a spin-off of the Arizal system, by which he produced amulets and incantations and all sorts of other cool stuff which people believed really worked and made miracles. And this became not just for the time during Shabtai Tzvi himself, but even well after his death for 100 years or perhaps even a little bit more or less 100 years, there were Sabbateans. Now that means people who believed the Shabtai Tzvi, even though he was no longer alive, and before he died, he converted to Islam, he was still the Mashiach, right? He was still Mashiach, and he was going to come back.
Well,
Islam before he died?
He converted to Islam.
Why would he do
that?
Because
like
they were going to kill him if he didn't.
They gave him a choice. They gave him a choice.
It sounds like something today.
Yeah, it's, you want to say it's similar to Lubavitch. But the...
Rebbe.
That's what he wanted to say. He just didn't say it.
He wanted to say it.
But I'll tell you, there are differences. The one of the differences is that, you know, in the array of spheros, so their personalities which are associated with each one. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, David. So Shabtai Tzvi, if I recall correctly, took Yaakov out, who was the leader of Tiferet, and guess who put in instead?
Himself.
Right. Because he was the Mashiach. So therefore he was the ultimate Tiferet, the ultimate glory of the Jewish people. And there were lots of Kameis. And also, of course, one of the reasons people are not supposed to learn Kabbalah at an early age is because much of Kabbalah has very highly sensuous references. There was a relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people, and the influence through Kabbalah, through the spheros, is portrayed in a very, very sensuous manner, if you get my drift. And does anybody not understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I ignore him.
What? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to
understand.
Somebody will explain it to you if you want. So I just want to say that last.
When you're older.
It connects to Hashem. You can find ourselves later, basically.
Yeah, but I know, we know what the spheres are, but the way Shabtai Tzvi approached them was as, you know, in a way in which he then himself copied with women. I don't know if I can be more explicit than that. That's why Shabtai Tzvi himself married a harlot.
What does that mean?
And a woman of ill repute, right? That was to uplift her by his emanations. And, what?
She was Jewish,
yeah,
sure.
So he wasn't so religious, was he?
Well, he claimed he was. And that's why Shabtai Tzvi also ate treif. Because he claimed that he was what? Yeah, I believe he did make the bracha matir asurim on that. If I recall correctly, you are correct about that.
He
allowed that, which is also, in other words, there's some obscure references in Kabbalah which seem to say that when Mashiach comes or in the world to come, that chazir will become pig will become kosher.
Can't
wait, man. Shabtai Tzvi paved the way. Right? Yeah. That he was matzah, these through him, and said that now it's Mashiach time, we can uplift all the sparks of Kedusha, which are even in the great Tumah of a Chazir. And he had a Talmud, whose name was Nathan of Gaza, came from Gaza, Gaza Strip, who went around publicizing Shabtai Tzvi's miracles, and his prophecies, and his divinity, and all the things he could do. And as I say, even after Shabtai Tzvi died, for many, many years, there was still many, many Sabbateans, people who followed this Sabbatean mode of, I guess, let's call it for these people, Avodas Hashem, which had to do with a lot of kind of licentious behavior. It's part and parcel of the rituals, and even though people were not licentious, they used Sabbatean Kabbalah, and this became in the mid 1700s one of the major causes of battle between great rabbis in Europe. Rabbis would accuse other rabbis of being closet Sabbateans. Okay, there was a famous machlokes which we'll get to later on between Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz. And Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, Rabbi Yaakov Emden accused Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz of being a closet Sabbatean. But the fact is that Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz's son was definitely a Sabbatean. He wrote Sabbatean tracts. This is mid-1700s. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden said about the father that he also was a Sabbatean, which Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz stoutly denied. And there's a fascinating material from that time about who Rabbi Yaakov Emden, he sniffed out Sabbateanism wherever he looked, and he had a printing press. So so he was able to publicize these things. This became a major battle. Yes, I was considered one of the great Gedolim of his time. And personally, he may well have had inclinations to Shabtos. Even if he did, they were very limited and probably more innocuous.
So do we say that there's some actual grounding in what Chavtai-Tzvi had to bring to the world? And saying, you know, was it like sort of like a type of Avodah Zarah where there's some basis but it's directed in the wrong fashion? Do we say that there were some, I don't know, Kabbalistic...
There has to be some consistency because many people fell for it.
Right.
Even great rabbis fell for it.
Right.
Okay.
So we definitely did have some sort of power.
He must have had some sort of power.
You know,
nothing else.
Yeah.
If nothing else, he was like, you know, a Rasputin type figure. Somebody who was able to hypnotize you and, you know, get into your soul. Yeah.
Frank also knew a lot of...
Frank was later on. He was after Shabbatitsky died.
He said that he was a guru. And a lot of people followed him too.
Right. Not a lot, but there were people, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did he study the Gemara?
He studied Gemara. Probably he studied some Gemara. But the main thing, he was Kabbalah.
So he would change what diary he had and change it
in
his own language?
Yeah. He made his own variations on it. Okay, so he comes and he announced himself as Moshiach in 1666. Right? 666 was also, as you know, a very important number in Christian theology. Right? In the book of Revelations in the Christian Gospel, says beware of the beast, and his mark is 666, and therefore 666 is considered to be a significant date in Christian history. And a lot of Christians also, you know, fell for this Shabtai-Tzvi perhaps being, if not Moshiach, the second coming, whatever he was. And he went from town to town in Europe, and convinced people that he was the guy. And most of Chrysler at the time believed that Shabtai-Tzvi was Moshiach. Most of Klai Yisrael fell for it.
What about Rabbanim?
Most Rabbanim fell for it.
Who held out to fight him?
What?
Who held out that fought him at the time? The leaders that
I don't remember names.
So he could have been a potential real, but he didn't succeed.
I don't think so. I think he was a fraud to begin with. But he was a dangerous fraud.
He just wanted to fight?
What?
He just wanted
the glory.
That's it?
He the glory.
He went crazy?
No, he did not go crazy. So as he was going from place to place, he came to Turkey, which is his birthplace, and the Sultan was kind of annoyed because, you know, he owned Palestine at the time, and he was not so happy with this idea of Shabtai-Tzvi coming and liberating Palestine, the original Palestinian Liberation Organization. So he gave Shabtai-Tzvi a choice: either Shabtai-Tzvi converts or dies. So yeah, so Shabtai-Tzvi chose the path of least resistance, and he became a Muslim. Now, he lived for many years as a Muslim. Yeah.
Is that acceptable? Because I heard the difference between Islam and Christianity.
Yeah.
You can't convert to Islam either.
It's
even though it's more monotheistic than Christianity.
Right.
You can't renounce the core Jewish doctrine, even regardless of what religion it's for.
So you gotta get your head chopped off?
Sorry?
You gotta get your head chopped off?
You gotta get your head chopped off, but he didn't want to.
Well, excuse me, on the matter of life and death.
Why didn't you run away?
No, you can't.
Why didn't you run away?
He was stuck, obviously. They put him in prison.
Why couldn't you just fake it?
I worship.
What?
What?
Oh.
That's the question I was asking.
So, Rabbi said, that's the people who continue to be Sabbateans. The people who continue to be Sabbateans after Shabtai-Tzvi's conversion claim that this too was part of the the preparation for Mashiach, for the Messianic age, that he went down even deeper into the Tumah, into the Klipot, in order to bring up even deeper sparks of Kedusha, and it was really just superficially became Muslim, not that he really became a Muslim inside. And he's just playing the game in order to be Ovid Hashem under those circumstances. Okay?
That is not Ovid Hashem. Hashem wants you to have your head be chopped off.
I know that, and you know that, and so does Shabtai-Tzvi know that. But his followers needed to justify what he did, and that's how they justified
it. Why didn't Hashem just punish him?
Yeah, Hashem did punish him. Hashem made it, Hashem gave, you know, caused him to convert, allowed him to convert to Islam. Why did he cause him to burn in this world?
I'm saying, like, if you say some things in Kabbalah, you're going to burn up in a second.
Yeah, but I guess
no.
I guess he kept himself safe. Maybe he was such a big fraud that he never said anything Kabbalah, which would get him burned up. I don't know. I don't know why Hashem sends these concerns. It's a big question. How does Hashem, why does Hashem send these temptations? The obvious answer which one can give, if you're a chassid, is that all this paved the way for chassidus.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas had there not been any tachvatat, had there not been this mass depression, had there not been the Shabtai Tzvi, chassidus would not have flourished the way it did. Chassidus became later on the antidote to this depression and despair and these false messianic hopes. So you could say that the reason Hashem brought all these things to be is because he wanted to pave the way for the Baal Shem Tov. One could say that. It's just one possibility.
This was not the only thing that emerged, right?
What else?
I don't know. What are those movements called? There are movements that emerged, and this is not the only one that came out of it.
The former conservative.
You mean it's Nazim?
No. Yiddish is
no, it's much later.
That
Hasidism
came from that, no?
No. Yiddishism is the late 1800s. Not so, Hasidism started in the early 1700s. So that, the isms came much later. The other isms. The important thing to remember, though, is that because Shabtai Tzvi was very Kabbalistic, so it caused a major backlash against Kabbalah. And they came out then, the Shach, one of the great commentators in Yerodea, I think maybe the Taz as well, came out with a ban on people learning Kabbalah until they were 40 years old. This learning Kabbalah, not being able to learn Kabbalah until you're 40, was a direct result of Shabtai Tzvi.
How about Sephardim?
It seems didn't accept to the same extent, but they also shied away from Kabbalah at this time. By the way, there were until around the mid 1900s, there were still followers of Shabtai Tzvi. Now they more or less assimilated into the surrounding Turkish population. But in Turkey, in Izmir, and other places, there were still Shabtai Tzvi followers. They're called the Dodmeh. I don't remember what the term comes from. They have very interesting customs. Like, for example, every year, they have a wife swapping event.
Ooh.
So that goes back to
it
says it's a cool religion.
What?
So that
oh my gosh.
That again goes back. The done man. They're not distinct from the general Muslim population.
Are they Jewish?
They are Jewish by hereditarily Jewish, but. You know, they have cut themselves off from the Jewish nation, just like the Karaites did before them. They cut themselves off.
What's their explanation of that? That their sheikh died? Are they saying he was Christian? They just said he's come
back? Right? Just like?
He's come back?
No.
The
Okay, I am
nobody. By the way, there is no problem saying Mashiach is coming back. No, that's not the problem with Lubavitch. The problem with the other problem. But Mashiach, it's quite possible Mashiach will be somebody who died and comes back to life. Not beyond the letter, not beyond reason. The Rambam doesn't hold that way, but it could be that happens. But, of course, Shabtai Tzvi made these changes to the religion. You know, wife swapping doesn't appear in the Torah as one of the positive commandments. So therefore, these changes which he made, which were because of the messianic nature of the times, those are obviously things which indicate to us that he was a Mashiach, but yet his followers, who still believe he was a Mashiach, they took these practices as the new practices ushered in by the Messianic Age. Yeah.
Then what is the problem with the garbage?
It's much later.
Yeah, you want 5 minutes before the end?
Yes, we're going to leave.
We also have to talk about Lubavitch. We spoke about Lubavitch.
A long time ago?
Over a year.
We're doing the Rambam.
Okay, so next Monday. We'll do it on Monday. Okay?
Monday's a break.
What's next Monday?
Monday's break? Is Wednesday break?
Yeah.
No.
This coming Wednesday?
This year, Wednesday.
Okay, we'll do Lubavitch on Wednesday.
Very good.
Okay. What's the topic? The problems of Lubavitch?
Anyway, the
just to finish up
for this period. So as I said, there was this major backlash against Hasidim, against Kabbalah, and it was actually the Hasidim who were the ones who really reversed the trend. Now I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. The Ramchal, for example, or Moshe Chaim Lusato, who was born in 1707, he was tormented during his lifetime and was not accepted during his lifetime because he was very heavily into Kabbalah, and he had what he asserted were prophetic experiences, and the other people, they didn't want any part of this, so they did not allow him to publish any of his works. They kicked him out of Italy, and they put him in Chayim. But they wouldn't publish his works, and finally, only after he died, did his works actually become widespread. So this Ramchal was an example of somebody who was held under suspicion by other rabbis because Kabbalah had become frowned upon. So Kabbalah, for a long time, had to be studied like under the table or in secret. Because people, as a result of Shapetri's whole Kabbalistic stuff, so people became very wary of Kabbalah. So again, to sum up what we saw tonight, we had the Tach V'Tach, Zeres Tach V'Tach, with the Chmelnitsky, and all the various reasons which we have for it, and then we have afterwards a period of major depression in Judaism, and a period in which people looked at first towards Kabbalah, then this Kabbalistic Mashiach appears on the scene, and things go, and people embrace it, and things go devastatingly wrong again, terribly, terribly wrong. People are major demoralized, depressed again. This time they're depressed and anti-Kabbalah. Okay? That's how the 17th century ends. I want to tell you just one more thing about the Tosfos Yontif before we stop. The Tosfos Yontif had actually. He had his own personal fast day and personal holiday. There's a very famous story about how Tosfos Yontif got into he was thrown to prison, and he would languish there for quite some time until he was somehow miraculously saved. So he made a decree on all of his descendants to keep a certain day a year as a fast day, the day his troubles started, and a certain day as a feast day, I believe, Hey Ador. As a feast day, because that's when his troubles ended. So to this very day, there are descendants of Tosfos Yontif, and the descendants, there are many descendants. Very few of them keep the fast, but a lot of them keep the feast. And I am told that many people who otherwise would have no shaykhus to Judaism have shaykhus because they participate in the annual Yontif of the Tosfos Yontif.
When's the Yontif?
Sorry, I think it's Hey Ador.
When's the fast?
I don't remember where the fast is.
Hey,
I think it's Hamas.
Out of recent or out of Arabic?
I don't remember.
Are you both?
Yeah. It should be relatively easy to find, but offhand I don't remember. One other thing I want to say before we stop is that there is, in Lithuania specifically, always the tradition that the world is made for Torah, and that Torah is the be-all and end-all, and therefore, I don't know if they had time to get depressed, because they were learning the whole time. And they focus, of course, if you are a member of the intellectual elite, then the world is much more, much easier place to cope with. It's only the masses, the peasants, who thought, well, you know, this is the salvation, and now they're back to square one, and they don't have the source to console them. These are the people who really suffer as a result of all these persecutions in an emotional and theological way. And that's why Hasidus, when it did come about, found its greatest appeal among the peasants, the low people, the simple people, who didn't have this intellectual satisfaction. Hasidus gave them major emotional satisfaction.
Why was the Gross so opposed?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Okay, everybody, fine. I think we'll stop here for tonight. So, Lubavitch on Wednesday.
Thank you.